Well, hi everybody, thanks so much for accepting the invitation, for being here, and thanks so much to Seida Barrera and Ernesto Dominguez for accepting the invitation to present here on the Latin American Caribbean Center. They are going to talk about two different topics, but related topics. Seida, she's going to talk about the Cuban economic actors and their dynamic, and then Ernesto is going to talk about the Cuban DS.
The other way around. I'm going to be first.
Oh, sorry. Ernesto's going to be first and then say that. And Ernesto's going to talk about what you can see there, about the relationship between the Cuba and the United States, one of the most complex relationships, perhaps, in the world. And it's ongoing. I'm just going to give you a very brief introduction for two speakers. And then they are going to talk for, let's say, 25, 30 minutes. And then we're going to open the conversation with them to ask questions and discuss more specific points. But if you want to ask something somebody not clear, it's okay. I mean, you can interrupt them. They won't be offended.
We have to do the answer.
Okay, perfect. So Ernesto, he has a PhD in historical sciences from the University of Havana. He's a full professor and coordinator of the U.S. study group at the Center for Hemispheric and United States Studies at the University of Havana as well. Ernesto's research interests include the study of post-industrial capitalism, U.S. political system and processes, Cuba-U.S. relations, international relations, political theory, and theory of history. And Seida, she has a PhD in juridical sciences, a GED, both from the University of Havana, in both as summa cum laude, full professor and associate researcher of the Center for the Study of the Cuban Economy at the University of Havana. She's been a visiting scholar and lecturer at different universities in the US, France, Spain, and in Finland. And her research interests have focused on state-owned enterprises, cooperatives, and self-employees. So thanks again, and go ahead, Ernesto.
Okay, good evening, everybody. It's a pleasure for me to be here. This is our first time in Britain. We have had a couple. I had a lecture yesterday. This is our first joint activity and my second personally. I'm happy to be this room so crowded with people. Mm-hmm. I'm just kidding. But the good part in here is that we can have an actual conversation. We have room for conversation, which is actually what we prefer. So I'm gonna be talking a little bit about Cuba's relations, specifically paying attention to the most recent events in the last few years, especially the last couple of years of the Obama's administration and the first couple of years of Donald Trump's administration, which I'm sure you know that are two very different administrations, two very different presidents, therefore two very different sets of policies that have included very different approaches to the relationship with Cuba. I'm going to be presenting you with sort of a model to study the way in which these policies towards Cuba are made in the United States based on a couple of reference from the historical perspective and from a poli science perspective. And I'm going to be applying that model to those two different moments in the relationship in itself to trying to determine, especially why, and try to explain why those policies have been made and implemented in the last few years. This is what I intend to do. I will do that in the next 25 to 30 minutes. Of course, I cannot cover everything. It's absolutely impossible to do it. I don't know. But typically, we teach whole semesters on this, so there will be many things that will not be included in the presentation. So hopefully, if you have any other doubt or question or interest, we can address that in the Q&A section, which I'm looking forward to it. So, without further ado, this is basically what I'm trying to do, and that is what I call a set of premises. We also part of this yesterday. So there is a set of premises that I think that are really important to consider when we are dealing with Cuba's relations. First of all, we are talking about a relationship that is multidimensional and complex, meaning that you just cannot reduce it to just one aspect. It's not just a political relationship. It's not just an economic relationship. It is that, and it's also cultural, social, and it has also, and this is very important, it has a long history. We're not talking about, this is not Britain-France kind of long history, for example, but it's a long history, it's at least 200 years. And we are talking about countries that are, from the modern perspective, new countries or new nations. Therefore, this relationship between Cuba and the United States have been there for a huge part of both countries' histories. So it is very important to understand it, to understand both countries' histories. And also very important, this relationship have been articulated around the two national projects, the Cuban national project and the United States national project. Two projects that are very different in nature. In the Cuban case, we're going to look at it in a second, but in the American case, I think it's quite obvious, which that is about building a nation, yes, but building a global power, which means creating a power structure that supports that role of the United States in the world. This is fundamental to understand, because that means that when we look at Cuban history, if we look at the idea that the Cuban national project is to build essentially a nation, to define it and to build it, and considering a few other aspects, those two national projects were in course of collision since both were set as both countries' national projects. Because, of course, if you get to be somewhat subordinated to a foreign power, you are not a sovereign nation. That is, I will say, so crystal clear that I don't think there is any doubt about that particular aspect. So, this is what I call the conditions that have been acting for centuries in Cuban history. And looking this from the Cuban side, but of course, I will try to go way beyond this. First of all, Cuban economy is an open economy, in the sense of an economy that is dependent on its foreign international sector. That is, international trade, foreign investment, different sorts of funding, like international credits, etc., to develop. This is not something that is new. This is not something for the last 15 or 20 or 20 years. This is something that has been going on for more than two centuries, because it's a very important and a structural consequence of the formation of the Cuban plantation system that was back in the late 1700s, early 1800s. So we have been dealing with this for the last 200, 230 years, roughly speaking. Which, by the way, today we can't determine. There is always a statistic about it. The Cuban international sector, the Cuban economy, represents somewhere between 35 and 45% of the total Cuban GDP as an average. Is in that range, which means that the entire economy depends on that. That is very significant. It is also the other aspect, which is migration, the movement of people back and forth, coming into Cuba, going from Cuba elsewhere, and the United States is part of this, because it's not only Cubans going to the United States, which is in the recent years is the way which that happened, but it's also a long history of Americans coming to Cuba for different reasons. People going to study in one place or the other, people going for business, people going for political reasons. This has been a process of circulation of persons between both countries for centuries, including some of the most relevant Cuban persons. I'm talking about José Martí, Cuban natural hero, and a few of the other major characters in Cuban history. Lived at some point in the United States, therefore getting to know the United States and getting into relationship with the United States as society and culture. Also very important, both countries have had a very intense relation with different global powers, from Spain and Portugal and Britain, France, all the way to Soviet Union and China and Russia. It's needless to say that have been shaping the relationship, of course, when we add here the geopolitical component of the relationship, which is not only about social bonds or economic ties, it's also about geopolitics and the way in which, of course, looking at the map and looking at the distribution of power in the world, the policies, especially from the American side, are made so they will advance in their goals, considering those particular conditions of the case of Cuba, which have everything to do with Cuba's geographical location. And that happened to be there, so at the very center of a very important region, that is important especially because of this. These are the most important routes for international trade, for the movement of people. You know that until today, as of today, 80 to 85% of the international trade in goods is by sea. And for the last 500 years, these routes have remained essentially the same, with the addition of the Panama Canal, for example, in the early 1900s, which added relevance, if something added relevance, to this region. And Cuba is located here. So it is quite clear that from a geopolitical point of view, Cuba is fundamental for any power that is here, like the United States is, that is willing, is trying to create a power structure that supports its projection worldwide. It needs to secure its surrounding area, and this is political realism 101. They need to secure the surrounding area, not only as a way to protect itself from potential threats, but also as a way to secure political support, access to markets, access to resources of different kind, and so on. I'm going quickly on this, but these are premises for the analysis we're going to have in a couple of minutes. Okay, this is also a very important idea. Based on that historical approach, we're now going to look at the ways in which U.S. makes, or the U.S. government makes Cuba, this Cuba policy. And it is a fundamental idea which I think is so obvious that should not be stated, it doesn't need to be stated, but quite often foreign policy is separated from domestic policies. Foreign politics is quite often separated from domestic politics. And I do think that will be a major, major mistake. Relatively recently, there have been certain development of an idea that is the intramestic nature of foreign policy, which I don't think is even necessary because, in my view, this is how it is. It is a public policy. Therefore, it answers to the same factors that drive foreign public policy, with the addition of having to deal with international imperative, having to deal with actors that are other states, having to deal with other specific conditions. But the decisions are made by the same structures and driven largely by the same forces within each country. What changes is some other aspects that are not part of the country itself. And if that's so, any public policy goes through a process. This is one of the several versions about the process of policy making. There are different ways to address it, but all of them essentially describe the same. I just choose one that presents the different steps of the process. As you see, it is a cycle. That doesn't mean that when it ends, now you start a different cycle. No. It goes all the way back to the beginning, and then you review the policy and you reshape it, or you change it, or you look for something else all the time. And if you look at there is not a word about institutions necessarily. Institutions are a major part of this, but it's not only about institutions. It's about the different forces and actors that participate in the process, including power groups, including interest groups, including constituencies in some cases, including corporations, international actors, other states that have a say in of this process through different means, and of course, individuals with a specific interest and influence in the process. Each one of these actors in this model make its own decision about what kind of policy support based on this matrix. I'm proposing this. A matrix that includes four dimensions. Each one of them is a complex dimension that includes several variables, but we can synthesize it in these four. The interest of that particular actor, the imperative meaning, in this case, the structure in place, the rules of the decision making, the rules of the policy making, for example, the interest and strength of other actors in the system, the specific conditions at each moment, and so on. You have to consider also, of course, the resources each of these actors has in talking about political capital, talking about material resources, talking about anything that particular actor can mobilize in favor of supporting that actor's interest. And of course, the fourth dimension, which is not sufficiently explored, in my opinion, which is the knowledge dimension. There have been some work on this. Yesterday we were talking about that specifically when there was a a book presentation by Megan Black from the International History Department. It was a quite interesting thing, which was about the global interior. That is the name of the book, which is about the construction of the American Empire from their own point of view using the Interior Department's interesting book. But one of the aspects is, when we are talking about this, and I ask this question, we have the conversation about this, is knowledge includes several aspects. It's knowledge about what is happening outside, meaning knowledge about the imperatives that are out there, knowledge about the resources that we have, and of course the interpretation of what is of interest for each actor. And of course that also means a knowledge about the balance of forces, the balance of power that organize those different actors within the system. That means that the final decision that is made, the final policy that is made, is a function of the balance of forces of the different actors that exercise certain influence on the process, institutional and non-institutional actors, around a specific issue or a specific set of issues. In the case of the Cuba police, of course, they have to do with the groups and individuals that have an interest in the case of Cuba, in a specific policy for Cuba. So we might see a menu of different potential public policies or policies regarding towards Cuba, that its implementation or not depends on the balance of power at each specific moment. In conditions that evolve over time, that's why this is a dynamic model, this is a dynamic process that cannot be reduced to one specific non-changing structure or non-changing set of actors and specific power structure. We have to look at it in movement. These have been also connected to the idea who has more influence on policy decision, on policy making. There is, at the very least, four theoretical traditions, and just there is two of them here. They are rooted in literature. They are very important. They have created a field for the development of huge amount of theoretical work. This is the other two major theoretical traditions, mostly American authors and specialists in American politics. But luckily for us, in 2014, it was published a very important article that tried to determine which one of these versions, which one of these theories actually explains the evidence that they could gather. It's an article by Gillens and Page, 2014, and they took 2,000 points of policies, and they studied which sector of society had the biggest influence on the process. As you see here, this line represents the probability that a decision is made, and down here, you see the percentage of the population they're studying that supports that particular decision. That particular decision that is probably or not to be made according to this figure up here. Which this means is, in this case, is average people, regular people. 10% of the regular persons, 20%, 30%, 40%, and so on. So, increasing percentage of the population, data population, supporting one specific policy decision. And as you see, probability remains the same. Translation. Public opinion has very little effect in the probability that a decision is made. Again, this is not me. This is an empirical research that was conducted by American political scientists. We may have a discussion with them or not, but this is so far the most advanced empirical study on this particular matter. Things are starting to change when it comes to elites. Elites defined as the economic elites, the people on the top of the social hierarchy in terms of income and wealth. I think it's quite the same thing, percentage and probability. I think that it's quite clear the different behavior of the probability when we talk about, when we are looking at elites and not at general population, right? When most of the elites are against, it will most likely not happen. And of course, that probability increases as we increase the percentage of those elites that support that decision, that political decision. And when we go to interest groups, it is quite interesting. This is a very interesting chart. You see there is a big jump ahead, big jump here. When you have a positive number with the total of groups, the net total of groups that support or that are in favor or against a political decision is positive, meaning there are more in favor than against. So, I think this study is quite clear. It goes to elites and interest groups way more than to public opinion and constituents when we talk about the major influence in the political decision making. So, if we apply this to the Cuban case, that means that the policy towards Cuba is defined mainly by the interest of elite groups and interest groups, which I think is consistent with what happens. Why? Because, first of all, there is not just one elite. There is a series of different groups. This is the way in which I'm looking at it. There is a way to say, there is at the very least a few traditions in here. You have the single, the monolithic version of what an elite is, which is this just one elite. There are several elites. Or there is a social class approach, which essentially you can consider that is similar to the one elite proposal, although social class is much wider than elite. In any case, I'm proposing there is two analytical levels. There is a degree of convergence and agreement on the general goals for the country, for the system at large. But then the specific policies through which those goals may be achieved are the ones that changes and between one group and the other. And the political debate we have then goes to the specific forms and the specific policies that are needed to achieve those goals. Using that, let's look at Obama's presidency and his Cuba policy. As you know, or probably, most probably know, in December 17, 2014, there was a huge announcement in which President Obama and President Raul Castro both at the same time spoke on both national TVs and announced to the world that Cuba and the United States had reached an agreement at the moment, negotiated in secret until the moment, to do a few things. To do what? To, first of all, restore diplomatic relations. And on the American side, that included the issue of general licenses for the different categories of travelers that can legally go to Cuba. I don't know if you know this, or how much do you know about this, but according to a law that was passed in 2000, only 12 categories of travelers can go to Cuba, American travelers can go to Cuba, none of which is tourism. All of them have to supposedly justify their presence in Cuba due to other reasons. But until that moment, they will have to choose, each program will have to apply for a specific license. With Obama, he issued general licenses to all these categories, so you only need to fit there. There was a process, honor system, in which you classified yourself and you could go. So it made it quite more easy to go to Cuba, quite easier to go to Cuba when compared to what it was just a year before that. And also, he extended licenses to American companies which are willing to operate in Cuba within certain limits. But of course, there was an opening that didn't exist before. As there were, this was also a decision of taking Cuba out of the list of countries that supposedly support terrorism. I'm using supposedly because I don't think there is any evidence that Cuba supported terrorism whatsoever, and not specifically not in the 30 plus years that this list has existed. If you read the last couple times in which Cuba was included in the list and the justification for that, there is, Cuba has advanced in this and that, but also there is a couple of people that are fugitive of the American justice, so therefore they are terrorists. So this is kind of nonsensical. So This changed with Obama, not right away. It took some time, but it changed in 2016. And he also eliminated the wet food, dry food policy. We'll have to explain this. I don't know if you know what it is, but it's basically the fact that Cubans who made it to the United States, no matter what, to U.S. soil, will be admitted as political refugees, and therefore they will have a safe track to become legal permanent residents in the United States, which, by the way, there is also a law, the Cuban Adjustment Act, passed in 1966, that gave them specific treatment. And, of course, that made that until 2017, when this policy was eliminated, that there were not illegal Cuban immigrants in the United States. There were people that arrived to the United States illegally, but when they arrived to the United States, they became automatically legal. It's a very unique case, in fact. And, of course, that's included the elimination of the Cuban Medical Professional Parole Program that have been meant to specifically attract Cuban medical professionals serving abroad to go to the United States, not to serve as medical professionals, but just extracted from the different areas. They only had to present themselves to the American consulates around. Why did Obama make this policy change? Using the model we were presenting, I was presenting earlier, we can perfectly say that it have to do, first of all, with an interpretation of the new reality, meaning the multipolarization of the world's of international system, with the emergence of powers that had the ability to compete with the United States, at least in certain aspects. And, of course, that meant that the U.S. had to focus on the certain areas in which the United States needed to reinforce. I'm talking from a very clear, realistic approach to politics, international politics and all of that, needed to reinforce or recover its influence if it will be keeping its position as the main global power. If you read, for example, works by Henry Kissinger, for example, if you read works by F.D. Nabrzynski, and some of the major, not only theorists, but in practice, policymakers in U.S. foreign policy, you're going to see that this is a very important school of thought. The idea that you should keep the balance, that you should keep control of certain areas and accept that other powers have the control of certain other areas and try to adjust your policy to your actual capabilities. So, largely, we can include this political war with Cuba as an adjustment, as part of this adjustment, because it was changing a policy that, for the American perspective or for the American side, it hadn't worked. That is very important. In that sense, Cuba was an irritant in the relationship with Latin America, which is fundamental. It's not that Latin America is the priority for the United States all the time, but it's so important that you cannot imagine the United States as a global power without exercising control in Latin America. And Latin America had gone through a process of changes, political changes, but important, what is called the pink tide in Latin America, with a number of left-leaning governments. And we also have to consider changes ongoing in Cuba. We're going to learn a little bit more about those changes afterwards. But there are changes ongoing in Cuba, very important ones. So it was also playing with this. And obviously, here we have to consider domestic politics in general. That means, for the first time, there were certain power groups within the United States that identified certain interests in Cuba that they needed to enforce, to implement, to advance in those interests, by establishing a different kind of relationship with Cuba, meaning the possibility of investing in Cuba, meaning the possibility of developing certain businesses with Cuba. And we also need to include here the fact that there were groups, even within the Cuban-American community, that has been historically opposed to this, certain groups, certain sectors that began to have a different approach or began to understand the relationship different, not only because of the new generation, new immigration, but even old generation Cuban Americans, the elder Cuban Americans, traditionally against that anything have to do with engagement with Cuba, that identify an opportunity to invest in Cuba, to do business. And probably the most famous case is the case of the Van Hool family. These are very wealthy people that used to own property in Cuba that say, okay, I'm not interested in that. I want to invest. I want to do business. There are others that are not, but I'm just saying that it's this group that saw the power balance, the balance of forces changed a little bit with a president and an administration that didn't owe anything to the traditional right-wing Cuban Americans. But then we had Donald Trump. I won't say a word about Donald Trump. Not too many, at the very least. But with Donald Trump, and this is just a list of things that happened, we have had an increase, a very quick increase, very rapid increase in hostility. Yeah, there's just another slide. So, this is just a little list. This is happening as we speak. This happened just a couple days ago. So, it's a, in a way, it's creating a hostility, a situation in which it's almost like trying to force Cuba to break the relation, as Cuba never did, by the way. It was US who broke the relationship with Cuba in the 1960s. So, this is something that has been happening. The question is, why? So, first of all, Latin America is a totally different place right now. You know, Bolsonaro in Brazil is not Lula or Dilma Rousseff. Mauricio Macri in Argentina is way to the right of the Kirchner government. Venezuela is having a lot of issues right now. There is a conflict ongoing. Ecuador changed its government, so its administration, and so on. So Mexico elected more to the left government, but it's not enough to compensate for this. So Latin America is very different right now as it was just in 2014. So consider that. And also, very important, this administration have had a very erratic foreign policy. In general, policy in general, but foreign policy in particular. Which have to do, I think is very clear, with the instability of the domestic alliances and the constant bargaining between different forces in a much more business-like environment. You know, the idea of having a business person in charge, which some people think is really good, apparently it's not that good when we look at what is happening in a country like the United States and the impact it's having around the world. And there is always this, an overstatement. I'm not saying that it's a misunderstanding, it's that it's an overstatement of the role played by Cuban Americans. And there is evidence that those Cuban American votes didn't give Florida to Trump. You know, the American system, you have to win in the states. It's not about the popular vote. He didn't win the popular vote, he won in the Electoral College. It's a very different system. So, that led the hardliners to come back to government, and they have been shaping this policy all the time. So, as you see, there is a different, there's a process of ongoing changes, there is a process of different groups seizing power, taking power in the states, a balance of powers within the country that allows for this, and of course, there is always a continuity of the main goal of U.S. policy, which is getting to recover some degree of control on the region and Cuba as the immediate frontier for the United States. So, policy scenarios, several. What's going to happen? No idea. Uncertainty is the biggest question, the most important word probably for this administration, and that was my presentation. Thank you.
Thank you.
Of the economic actors in our economy. But I changed a little bit my presentation because I wanted to connect more with Ernesto and, of course, the focus on U.S.-Cuba businesses, the little ones that we can make with U.S. So I divided my presentation in two main cores, the diversity of economic actors, their successes, the challenges that they face, and on that basis, Cuba-U.S. businesses. Of course, Ernesto already explained the importance of our location for commerce and so on. So, I put it in different colors. First of all, we have the state-owned enterprises and the commerce societies. Then we have the cooperatives. As you can see, we have four types, three agriculturals and one non-agricultural cooperative, and then we have the privates. Which are the differences? I put everything in property, who manages, if they are legal persons or not. As you can see, the privates are not considered legal persons yet, although there is a political will, it's in the guidelines from 2011 and also from 2016, but it's not, they are not considered entrepreneurs, commerce entrepreneurs yet. So we'll talk a little bit more about that. And then we have the numbers. SOS, the state-owned enterprises, as you can see, as I'm going to explain, they are legal persons, but they belong to the state. And they have that in common with these commerce societies. But the difference is that they are not divided into stock, as we can see with the commerce societies. And of course, they are considered completely public. Everything, the assets belong to the state. But we are proposing some changes, and they were heard. I mean, a lot of researchers, and in the Constitution, they put it in a very broad article defining what is considered a state-owned enterprises. And I'm giving my focus here because when you look at the numbers, you could see, well, we have in Cuba more cooperatives than anything else. Those are the most important actors in Cuba. But the truth is that although there are more cooperatives, the resources are located here, the majority of the resources, in the state sector. Why? Because that is how we can fund, that is how we can raise the money to give the population free health, free education, free defense, and other services. If anyone has a better idea of how to do that, we are open to ideas, but this is the way that historically, since the triumph of revolution, we managed to do. And in the case of the commerce societies, they are the ones who do foreign trade. As you can see, the numbers are not so big, only 236, according to the official statistics. That is good and bad, because it's very easy to locate them. You just go to the Minister of Foreign Relations and you're going to have all of the contacts. But the bad thing is that you cannot switch, because you have sometimes just one company that's going to do one specific thing and you cannot switch if you're not happy with that one. But they were created specifically to do foreign investment. So their authorization is by the Minister of Foreign Relations, Foreign Investment. And in the case of state enterprises, it's by the Ministry of Economics. So you can see there the differences. In the case of cooperatives, we had until 2012 only agricultural cooperatives. That was part, many authors have said the same. It was part of our inheritance from the former Soviet Union because we had that model for so many years. But we had, in those agricultural cooperatives, we are very important because they supply 70% of the food right now for the population, the food that we don't have to import. So they are really important right now in Cuba. And first of all, we have the basic units of cooperative production. In this case, the state belongs to the land, is the owner of the land, but they give it away to a cooperative. They're going to, it's what we call usus fructus. You can use the land for free, and you can take out the fruits, but you're never going to get the ownership. And if you don't work in that land, they're going to give it away, or they're going to put a tax. There is a new tax on that, just from a few years back. And they're going to give it to somebody else, because that's a matter of, right now, of national security. How much food can we produce for the population so that we don't have to import, because it's really expensive, because all of the international prices of food have just increased. And then we have the cooperatives of the agricultural and cattle production cooperatives. In this case, the farmers, thanks to the Act of Agrarian Reform, they got ownership on the land, but they gave it away to this huge ownership that became collective. It became part of the cooperatives. So they are not owners anymore. They gave that land away. And now, this was, they were the first ones, because it was, first of all, a spontaneous phenomenon, because after the revolution, when they got ownership, they wanted to associate. So they said, okay, just let's authorize them. But now, they are facing a problem, as they were the as they are the oldest one. The sons and the daughters of these farmers, they became lawyers and medical doctors, and another one to go to the farm anymore.
And historians.
Yeah, some study physics, some study history, and now they don't want to go back again. So they're having issues in order to get people to work in those farms again. And then we have the credits and services cooperatives. In this case, the farmers still own the land. They never gave it away to the cooperative. And in the national statistics, they are together with the privates. Me personally, there's a huge debate right now in Cuba about that in the academia, because, for example, I don't even consider that a cooperative, because the international organization says that you have to give some ownership to the organization you're going to belong to. And in this case, the only thing that they do together is management and some services, and to ask for credits to the bank, but that's not enough. So are they really a cooperative in that sense? There's a huge debate about that. And then we have the nomadic cultural cooperatives. Everybody's writing about that now because they are so new, so everybody wants to know. And in this case, they were born as part of an experiment. Right now, there's been 5 years since no new authorizations have come out, because they are working in the law, because there is a lot of legislation for cooperatives, and so they want to put everything together in a big package so that the equity between the modifications for both types, agricultural and non-agricultural ones, can be the same. And in this case, the land or the place is mostly rented or is private. What we have seen so far is that the state rents places, very good locations, and they have been doing, some of them have had difficulties, but we've known and we've visited many very successful cooperatives so far. And as you can see, the numbers are not big until that experiment finally finishes. So far, no new authorizations. And then the privates. I want to focus on self-employees, but it's important to know that they are not the only ones. We have many different types of privates in Cuba. There are still individual farmers. There are also people like in the basic unit of cooperative production who also have land in usus fructus, but they are individuals. They don't have to work with anybody else. We also have what we call tenants, people who are working in a certain piece of land, but they don't have any title over that land. So there are different types, but of course, the more numerous are the self-employees. As you can see, the numbers have increased, and with the guidelines since 2011, since the 90s, and lately they have increased their numbers every year. Actually, they have been the only ones who have increased in terms of employment. So given these differences, I'm going to talk about some of the successes and the problems. Right now, the biggest success that I see in the entire economy is that they have managed to actually make bonds, to make nets between them. Not only contracts, sometimes without a contract, they even collaborate because they need services or material raws. And they miss, we have seen these spontaneous nets that then, with time, become contracts. But that is also a problem because they are still insufficient. That's part of my PhD. I'm proposing, for example, that between nationals, they can form joint ventures, and also they can have contracts of association, official contracts of association, because that is possible with foreign investment. Why not do that with the nationals? And another thing is that the insufficient data, because, for example, well, it's important for the economists and the accountants to know what's the contribution of each one of these different actors. But the statistics so far make it impossible. For example, we had to go to the GDP, estimated contribution, but per activity. And we had to put together the activities that can only be performed by the state sector, state entrepreneurs. And when you can see, this is only 4.6% in public and is concentrated mainly in public services. But most of these activities can be performed by everyone. It can be performed by cooperatives and it can be performed. So you cannot actually define what's the contribution to the GDP. It's actually impossible. There are estimates, but you cannot actually know. And that is a problem for us, because how you're going to make strategies and how you're going to support some of your ideas if you don't know their concrete contribution. And another problem is that low efficiency of SOAs, although, according to the last data, from the numbers that you saw, about 1,700, those are the most important ones, but only 45 had actual losses. So the majority of these of those state enterprises are efficient, but not enough. And of course, USA blockade is transversal. I put it like that, big, because you cannot talk about the view of human economy if you cannot talk about the blockade, because in commerce, it's a nightmare just to find a client, a bank, a provider that is not afraid of US sanctions. For us, is you have to be there. You have to be there with the officials looking for a bank. They exist. I just finished to write a presentation with one of the members of the Slovakian embassy, and he told me, you're not going to believe it, but we don't have any problem with blockade, because we have the bank that doesn't have any interest, because it's hard to find a bank who doesn't have any interest in the United States, but they do have it. And we have the enterprises who doesn't have any interest in the United States, so they are free to go to Cuba, and they're not afraid of sanctions. And I was like, I can't believe it. And I said, yes. And he gave me all the contacts so we could interview those people. But for the rest, for the majority of the countries who try to make business with us, it's not easy. And when you look at the tendencies before and after the guidelines of 2016, there are fewer state-owned enterprises. Some of these enterprises, the state decided just to make them go to extinction because they were not efficient, and that is one of the changes in policies. Instead of giving them subsidies, they just decided, okay, if you're not efficient, I'm going to watch you for 2 years, and if after those 2 years you cannot be efficient again, then you're going to extinction. We're also looking at fewer agricultural and cattle cooperatives because of the problem, but there are many other factors than that. The stop, there are no new authorizations on agricultural and cattle cooperatives until the experiment finishes. There are more private businesses, along with all of the different examples I gave you. There is more foreign investment, but it's not enough. We are about in 2%, and we need 6% at least in order to actually say that the economy is growing. Triana has a paper about that. And of course, there is no currency unification. We have two currencies, and which has a big impact because of the distortion for the economy that means, because for example, state enterprises, they work with one-to-one. One COC, which is one of our national currencies, for one US dollar. But the privates, they can work with one COC per 24 Cuban pesos. So it's a huge change. In a hotel, in order to pay one Cuban peso, they have to put one COC. But the private, he can go and exchange it, and he pays to a worker 1 to 24. And inside of that, the real problem are the exchange rates. We have so many different exchange rates for everything, and it's a big distortion. But since 2014, we have legislation for the zero day when the unification is going to happen. But one of the reasons that it hasn't happened yet is because the state doesn't want to hurt the population, because there is going to be distortions, of course. There's going to be this balance in the economy because of that. And some of the challenges, I just put the most important ones for each actor. They still, in the case of state-owned enterprises, they still have dependence at the superior level. There's still bureaucratism. that are still grouping for political will instead of production necessities. We are still, we're working on that right now. In the case of cooperatives, equity with each other, with the new legislation, let's see how that works. They have to learn how to be, because there are a lot of cooperatives, but sometimes the members, the associates, they don't know what is to participate. They don't know what is to be a member. And in the case of the non-agricultural cooperatives, the learning that they got from the officials was the legislation that was new, that nobody knew much about it. But nobody, I mean, for example, I used to work in a center of psychological and sociological research, and they said, but there are so many exercises in order to make a citizen or just a member of a company to show them how to participate, how to make debates, how not to fight each other when the distribution of the income at the end of the year comes, because there are big fights about it. And so we're thinking, but let's see what happens. In the case of self-employees, there is a list of forbidden activities, 126, so the last count that we made. But we're saying that it's better if you just let it free and just say, you cannot, as a self-employee, do this and this and this activity. It's going to be better because the numbers have changed around 5 times in the past 5 years. Wealth distribution, that is one of the issues in order to maintain the equity. That is one of the main cores in the government's policy to maintain equity. And in the case of foreign investment, of course, there are still long approval procedures. Sometimes it takes more than a year, and you cannot have a foreign investor waiting for a year to execute the budget that he has, because sometimes he doesn't have authorization to be waiting for more than a year in order to do it. And, of course, the USA blockade is omnipresent. And with all that basis in mind, let's get into Cuba-US businesses. It's important to say that from the part of Cuba, in terms of commerce, finances, we don't have any restrictions, we don't have any sanctions. So depends on the type of businesses. You have to go to the procedure, the legal procedure as designed. Depends if you want to have a firm in Cuba, a private firm, or if you want to do foreign investment, if you want a joint venture, if you want a contract of association, you have to consult. And those are the normal restrictions that any country has. But from our part, there are no sanctions at all. But from the part of the United States, there are 7 core legal regulations. And from those 7 core, I mean, this is the main body, but there are a bunch of presidential orders, which is funny because with presidential orders, it would be easy to break the blockade in so many ways. But they're using the presidential orders, exactly Trump, in order not to do that. And from those core legal regulations, 2 have go through this process. This is the process. I put a labyrinth because it was came to my mind. This is the process in order to approve an act in the United States. So they made 2 of them that they will have through this procedure, this labyrinth, in order to get rid of the, or to start getting rid of the blockade. And of course, you need OFAC, that is the office specialized in following US dollars. That is the one who was defined, Bank Paribas, all of those sanctioned actors abroad. So when you have all of this in mind, making businesses with Cuba, is it mission impossible? Let's see. The exports from USA to Cuba, you can say that's just nothing. And there has been some improvement in 2012, but since then it has diminished, even with Obama and with Trump, of course. But you're going to see this 84 codes of products, from corn to plastic materials, you name it, all kinds. But let's look at the importations from Cuba to USA. That looks, when I look at that, that comes to my mind, and the history, the treatment of reciprocity between Cuba and United States, where there was no reciprocity at all, because that's just nothing. And from the 84 that US exports to Cuba, there are only two codes of products: books, printed matter, artwork, antiques. And what about our tobacco? And what about our coffee? Our rum that is so appreciated in the United States? We know it because we have students and we meet with people for classes all day long, and that's what they want to take with them. But that's not possible so far. It hasn't been possible. And the few businesses, and on that Mission Impossible that you can see, well, we have four US airlines. All of this is mostly since Obama: Delta, American Airlines, Southwest, JetBlue. And those are the survivors, because Spirit, Alaska, they just could not handle Trump and the change of administration, because, for example, the amount of visitors from US, it went down up to 40%. And the ones who are suffering more are the self-employees, which is contradictory with the policy that Obama and all the other administrations say that they wanted to encourage self-employed, the private sector, but it's actually hurting them, because those US visitors go to those private places. They don't go to the hotels, to the state hotels. That's the situation right now. Seven crisis company, crisis companies, that is good, and they are increasing. Thanks to those crisis company, the amount of visitors last year saved the numbers. They were the ones who saved the numbers. But what happens is that when somebody comes in cruises, even people from the United States, they only stay for hours in Cuba. It's not the visitor that you keep in mind when you're doing your strategy for tourism, because you want the visitor who comes, who stays in a hotel, who actually goes to tours and all that, and that is not possible. And also, is the amount of money that they spend. It's about 50. On a regular visitor who comes for about 3 nights in Cuba, they spend 300. So it's good that the numbers have increased, but that doesn't mean that our incomes because of that have also increased. There is still one hotel chain, is this little tiny one in Fifth Avenue. That is one of our beautiful streets in Havana, but so far only one. 9 travel agencies, 2 telecommunications agencies, 5,000 Cuban websites to make businesses, with all the problems that we have to connect so far. It has improved, but it's not enough. Stock in companies doing businesses in Cuba, Nestlé, but not Ricard. About 32% belongs to the United States, but they've never had issues. They've been operating in Cuba for more than 20 years, and now they just renew their contract with Cuba because they were happy, and Nestlé, they are kings with ice cream in Cuba. That's a huge topic because it's always hot, and they're number ones in that business. There are two examples of very successful businesses in Cuba, and of course, one remittance company. This is the situation so far. As you can see, it's not much. So we hope that we can do better businesses with other lands, for example, UK, of course. And we also hope that things are going to be better. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Well, thank you for both of you. Thank you for staying within the time. So now we have like 20-something minutes to discuss some specific topics, questions that you may have, so go on.
So going back to the chart when you were talking about exports, and you showed the peak in 2012, I think it was.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so you showed this peak. I wanted to just ask the reason for that peak and then the dramatic drop.
Well, in 2012, the historical situation with US had some improvements, but the diminishing, I mean, reducing of the numbers is because they mostly ask for cash in advance. Nobody does business like that in the world. That was abusive. That is what we call in Cuba un contrato leonino, a leonin contract, lion contract, because it's like the mouse against the lion. And we just couldn't accept that for, I mean, Cuba can handle that, but for a while. You cannot pay in cash forever, because the way that you do business in the world is that you have a time, an amount of time you get credit, you sell, you recover the money, and then you give it again. But with those conditions, it was not easy, so we just could not, we don't have, it wasn't easy for us to pay.
And this was a lack of trust within the business community. Is this why they wanted cash?
It was not just a lack of trust, it was because Cuba in the negotiations, they say, okay, we have been doing this, you can trust that we're going to pay, but we cannot keep paying in cash, we need credits. As everybody else, here you have the list of traders, foreign traders, and they give us credits. If you are afraid that we're not going to pay, then just cut, because in anywhere when you don't pay, they cut the supplies. But that never happened. So Cuba said no. I'm just cutting my demand because I cannot sustain these conditions in the contract anymore. So it was a decision from our part.
But if I may, there is a couple other aspects that are important.
Mm-hmm.
One of them is after that there was a slowing down in the Cuban economy.
Mm-hmm.
The economy slowed down. That means that the ability to pay in this condition of cash and advancing of that, which is really difficult, were significantly reduced, was significantly affected by that situation. And also, look at the last year in this chart is 2018. So the environment was quite different in both moments. Even when in 2012, this is before the official change in policy, there were already things ongoing, and there was already a trend, visible trend, to improve the relationship, even without a declaration. There have been some comments about it, there have been some advances, even without that official declaration that something was happening, something will happen, or something had happened. Whereas in 2018, then we have a totally different situation. Without breaking the relationship with the diplomatic relations, we are moving backwards. So in a way, we can talk about a positive and a negative demonstration effect,
mm-hmm.
that will go directly to affect the will and the will to take risk by American companies in first place in the possibility of doing business with Cuba. Exporting to Cuba or buying anything from Cuba or doing whatever in Cuba. So probably this will add to the understanding of these two very different behaviors in these two different moments.
Hi, my name's Emma Saint. I'm a PhD student in international relations here at the LSE. Thank you very much for some really interesting presentations. I have a load of questions, but I'll try to restrict them to two. Firstly, given Cuba has led global rankings for education, gender equality, health for decades. Given allegations of support for terrorism are nonsensical, why do you think Cuba has been labeled repeatedly by America and certain other countries as kind of a revisionist or a rogue state for so long? I don't want to talk about Trump either, but why did it take so long? Why did it take up to Obama for that to slowly wear away?
This is specifically my field, right? Okay, there is a couple of things. First of all, the first thing that should be understood is that the Cuban Revolution meant many things, including the fact that Cuba went out of that power structure created by the United States since late 1800s, early 1900s, meaning that the Cuban Revolution essentially opened a hole or cracked that power structure. That means that, and from that point of view, To recover some degree of control on Cuba is a fundamental goal, or at least a permanent goal for U.S. foreign policy. Which, by the way, in the case of Latin America, the political of Latin America is not 100% foreign policy for the United States. If we look at the founding documents of U.S. foreign policy, from Monroe Doctrine to the Manifest Destiny to all those documents drafted by the founding fathers under second generation of leaders and so on, we see that the continent itself is considered to be legally given by God or whatever you want to put it, under the control of the United States, the way in which it should be. Therefore, for the United States, Latin America is not exactly foreign territory. It has been presented as U.S. backyard quite a few times, recently by Trump, in which he was just repeating what Ronald Reagan said, and which is essentially the vision of Latin America in the United States, have been the case for a long time. And Cuba is probably one of the first two or three interests in that, in Latin America, in that sense. That is, have been intense to control Cuba since before the U.S. was founded as a country. And there were repeated attempts to buy Cuba from Spain, and there was different actions in that sense. So it's nothing but the continuity of a historical process. And of course, accepting a state that is clearly establishing its as its goal to create a sovereign nation in that particular piece of land, meaning not accepting U.S. Control, not accepting its subordination to the United States, that means that that state is a rogue state, but not in the sense of a failed state or a state that supports terrorism. It's a state that doesn't accept the United States as its ruler or something. It's hard to put it in one specific word, but at least to accept the subordination to the United States that the United States expects from a country in this area. Cuba is in the very first ring of U.S. interest and U.S. national security, with quotation marks, because national security, from our perspective, is the security of the persons and the territory of the country. But in the case of the United States, it's the persons, the territory, and the interests of the United States. That is a little bit of a difference. And when you see you read the definitions that are in, for example, the strategies for foreign policy or for defense strategy for the United States and all that, you can see that that's the case. And of course, there is a second part, which is the definitions of what is a rogue state or what is a failed state, of what kind of a country is democratic or not, are based on one set of specific definitions that are essentially very, very small variations on the American system. Maybe accepting European system. Maybe. Not 100%, or at least accepting most of them, because of course there are historical reasons and political reasons. That's the other part. Something that is not within this very small framework will not be considered a democracy by the United States or by any other actor that essentially abide by this kind of specific rules. But what I think is the most important, we are talking about using the rhetoric and this kind of figures of speech and this kind of political instruments to advancing an interest, because when we look at U.S. foreign relations, we see that U.S. is a very, very close friends with Saudi Arabia, for example. That's a smoking gun every time we talk about the United States and the promotion of democracy. Yeah, Saudi Arabia, under any definition that you want, is not a democracy. By definition, they don't define themselves as a democracy. However, they're very good friends and nobody talks, in the public sphere, they don't talk about Saudi Arabia in those terms. I don't care for Saudi Arabia. They could do whatever they want as long as they support it. What I mean is that there are different ways to approach different countries and different situations, which depends on the relationship between U.S. and that country. So that will be my explanation for that. Even with Obama, there was the idea of promoting democracy in Cuba, which, by the way, if they don't consider the system in place a democracy, promoting democracy is another way to say regime change. Although they officially renounced with Obama to the idea of regime change, in fact, they were saying that they will be working on regime change. Let us just compare this to that, and I think that it's very difficult to deny that that's the goal. That's one question. The other?
Is that okay? Can I follow up?
Sure.
I'm keen to talk about it from the kind of other side side of the coin and talk about Cuba's foreign policy and their decisions at the international level, say signing international treaties. How much is their decision making, Cuba's decision making, affected by relations with the US or not at the international level?
I will say in that case, and probably people that work in that area are much better prepared than I am to talk about it. But the way in which we understand it in the academia is like this. The Cuban foreign policy, as any other foreign policy, depends on this set of processes that I mentioned, the idea of having certain specific interests, working with the imperatives that exist, knowing the resources that we have, and the knowledge we have about all of this. The problem is that the interest that Cuba has are totally different from those of the United States. First and foremost is to protect Cuba's independence and sovereignty, right? Which has included, along the time, one of the central axes of Cuban foreign policy, which is at the center, which is solidarity with, now they call it the Global South, and at the time it was called the Third World. It doesn't matter, we're talking about the countries and the peoples and the nations that are not in the top 30, 40 countries that are the powerful countries, the OECD, whatever, although we don't have an issue in getting into a relationship with any of those, as long as there's a respect for Cuba's sovereignty, for Cuba's status as a sovereign nation. So those are fundamental axes there. In that sense, of course, Cuba's policy decisions are affected by United States. We have to consider the effect that U.S. policies have on those counterparts. I'm talking about other governments. I'm talking about the specific situation for Cuba and for other actors or non-governmental actors. That's also important because international relations is not only about states. It's also about corporations. It's also about organizations of the civil society. It's also about the global society at large. So it's many other actors there. So we have to consider all of these process. Those who are the decision makers have to consider. And finally, I will say that despite all of that, there is a set of principles in the Cuban foreign policy that regardless of U.S. Policy and relationship with the United States, the Cuban foreign policy have been based on those principles. For example, there was a lot of discussion at the moment when we get into this normalization with the United States. That I use quotation marks for normalization because there is one problem. I advanced this yesterday, but none of you were here, I think. I don't know. The problem is that normalization means moving towards a normal situation. The question is, what does normal mean in that specific situation between Cuba and the United States? And most probably, Cuba has a definition of normal that is not the definition of normal that U.S. may have. Considering the history, considering the position of the countries, considering all of that. So I will say that that's part of the discussion. So there was a lot of discussion about if Cuba will sacrifice its relationship, let's say, with Venezuela to the reapproachment with the United States. The Cuban leadership from day one say, we will not sacrifice all our foreign policy to United States, to the relationship with the United States. We will support Venezuela because we believe in that process. We believe that it's part of the right of the people to have their own political system as they want and so on. I'm just mentioning Venezuela. We could go to any other area of the world in which Cuba and U.S. have different understandings and different visions on what is happening. You can go to the Middle East and you will find similar approaches and so on. So that's a way in which I interpret the influence of the relationship with the United States in Cuba's foreign policy.
I can also tell you, for example, when you look at the businesses, this is almost everything, like almost all of these, except for the companies that are doing business with Cuba that we are talking about 20 years back, almost all of these was during Obama's administration. So this is proof that while the doors were open, we don't have any problem. I mean, anyone who wants to come and have businesses, and if you consider that we are equal, just sitting on the same table and just exchanging ideas, no problem. And since Trump, all of that has changed, and even though some agreements have arose, just for example, the Rosa Parks agreement that
Crosswalk
is
Park.
About
Crosswalk Park.
Yeah, and about cancer and about making collaborations for vaccines and so and all that. This is something that was coming even from. It was an agreement that we were talking about. It was years before. So what changed? It wasn't us, because as long as there was a good policy and people were coming, we had no issues about that. So from our part, the answer to this situation that we are facing right now with Trump's administration is diversifying the horizons. Let's look into other horizons. Let's diversify even more the clients and the providers that we have today, because we cannot be dependent. We cannot repeat the same mistakes that we made in the past. We were dependent from Spain, then we were dependent from the United States. We're trying not to do that so hard, in spite of the blockade. So that has been the answer, I can tell you, in matters of business.
My name's Emily Morris, and I've been following the Cuban economy for a while. And first of all, I could confirm what you're saying about the difficulty of doing business, and including with the UK.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was the year before last, they opened up UK export finance to Cuba,
mm-hmm.
but it has to go through an agent bank. They haven't been able to find an agent bank who actually do business, and so it's almost impossible to do things. So at the moment I'm working on academic links, which are kind of a bit easier. But my question is for you, actually.
Mm-hmm.
It's about the relation. What's going on in the US at the moment is what I can't understand, and I don't know whether you have a view about the extent to which, in a way, I take what you're saying about interest groups and all the rest of it and the power they have, but the Cuban-American lobby is incredibly effective. It's not just
mm-hmm.
any other group. It's actually very, very well organized. And that relationship between Trump, who, before he was elected, he didn't have any particular opinion about Cuba. He just wanted to see if he could do business there.
Mm-hmm.
And then somewhere between there and here, he's fallen under the, it seems almost like the control of a group
mm-hmm.
of people. And I'm just interested in what you think is going on there.
Yes.
There's some theory that it's because he owes something to Marco Rubio, but it doesn't explain the whole
mm-hmm.
lot of people that he's got now in charge of Cuba and, in fact, Latin America.
Yes. If that's this question of yours allow me to expand on something that I just touched briefly, because I didn't have the time to do it properly. So thank you for that. First of all, about the Cuban-American community itself. The Cuban-American community is a community which is going through very important changes. Yes, there is new generations, new immigrants into the United States coming from Cuba that have a very different history, personal history, than the early ones, of course. But there is a problem. The power within the community is not in the hands of the early arrivals or the recent arrivals or the second generation on their own. It's in the hands of the old elite and their heirs in that sense. Like, for example, Marco Rubio himself or the other politicians, they are mostly the sons and daughters of those who arrived first, but they were forming this environment, especially because those are the ones who control the resources, and even more important, that the ones who created and control the political machinery that is so influential in local and statewide elections in Florida. Now, it's just one part of the problem. The problem is that, you know, in the American system, which the elections are by electoral college, there is this group of states that are the ones that are open for grabs in every election, and Florida is by far the biggest of those. They have 29 electoral votes, and the second biggest in that group is 18 electoral votes. So there is a huge chunk of the electoral vote, which in total is 535. So controlling Florida is critical for being elected. Therefore, the one who could deliver Florida will have an influence on the next president. In that sense, this political machinery in Florida is, but this is the way the expression used by a very important author, Alejandro Portes, who said the Cuban Americans have studied the Cuban American community for many years. He uses this expression himself, and just quoting him. This political machinery effectively is preventing other sectors of the Cuban American community to exercise some kind of influence in their political decision making, even when the vote itself is a split in that community. And that political machinery is also reflected in the Cuban American lobby in Washington, which is considered by all experts the second most influential ethnic lobby in the United States, just after the Israeli lobby, the AIPAC, which has been, by the way, under a lot of discussion recently by some remarks by Ilhan Omar, which only states something that is real. This lobby is extremely influential and move a lot of money and a lot of resources around. So the second most influential lobby, ethnic lobby, which typically focus on international or foreign policy, is a Cuban American lobby, which is controlled by this very same group of people. So we have there a set of actors that remain roughly in the same position and remain in control of a significant amount of resources. That's on the one hand. On the other hand, this administration in particular is very vulnerable to this, regardless of what Trump is saying, despite what he's saying, that he's, you know, the best of the world or whatever, and the most influential and effective and the best president and the best in everything. He says that, not me. Regardless of that, despite of that, in fact, this administration is vulnerable to the specific political situation because there's a lot of there's a huge fracture within Congress and within the political establishment in the United States, and that includes the effects of the investigation on the alleged electoral fraud or electoral crimes, so to be more accurate, and the everything that is going on with Robert Mueller probe on the possible collusion, etc., etc., etc. In that sense, advancing in trying to get rid of those issues depends largely on the positions of congresspersons on those issues. And remember that some of the Cuban Americans are placed in very important committees within both Senate and the House, including Marco Rubio, including Bob Menendez, which is a Democrat, but is totally anti-Cuban government. So you have there the possibility for these individuals and groups to exercise influence, and of course they demand something in return. The problem with the previous administration is that it had no business with these people whatsoever. Trump does. And then we can add to that a few other things, which is Trump have brought with him, and I don't know exactly how that came to be because it's very difficult to follow Trump's decision-making process, specifically in appointing people for certain positions, in particular for how quick they change. But if you see the evolution of his administration, you can see how the newcomers have been the more and more part of this hardline group of people, the hardliners. Because those are the ones who identify, this is an interpretation, the ones who identify in Trump a person who they could somehow help to make the decisions they prefer. Let's put it that way. And these are not the original neocons. They were really smart people. I'm not talking about their goals or what they did, but it's about really smart people. These are not the kind of neocons which have more sophisticated policies, probably, but they are very clear, crystal clear on what they want to do. That includes John Bolton, which was brought into the administration, and John Bolton has a long history in this position towards Cuba and all that. And finally, fourth, there could be many others, but this is another important dimension. They are not only looking at Cuba, they are looking at Latin America, and they are connecting Cuba to Venezuela, to Nicaragua as the remaining of that left or leftist, leftish sort of moment in Latin America. Cuba is the old one, is the final piece of the puzzle, but they have to go through the others. So it's not that they are attacking Venezuela to get to Cuba, it's that they see that's part of the same problem. If you see the policy towards Cuba are consistent with those two, those for Venezuela and to some extent to those for Nicaragua. And one comment that I want to say here is quite interesting. In the American political speech, typically when they were criticizing the Soviet Union and Israel, Europe, and Cuba and all that, historically, they used the word communism. They never used the word that we use, which is socialism. They always talked about communism. Okay, there is a misunderstanding of what communism is, there is a misunderstanding of what socialism is, but still, that was their political speech. However, recently, they have started to talk about socialism and the socialist countries like Venezuela and Cuba and Nicaragua, whatever. And they will say, socialism will never come to the United States, we will defeat socialism, it will never work. In the moment in which there is a political movement within the United States with representatives in Congress that are saying publicly that they are socialist and that they want to advance in socialist policies. So again, you have to think about it by connecting to their own domestic process. When they talk about, just in the day of the election day, around election day last year, midterms elections, when all this movement was happening and there was a lot of evidence that they will win many positions in Congress, which they did, by the way, John Bolton went to Miami and he pronounced a speech in which he attacked Cuba and criticized socialism at large. And then Trump restated that in his remarks about socialism will never come to the United States, etc., etc., etc. So when you look at that, you can see that these speeches, even when less sophisticated than those by Obama, they are multivocal and they are talking to many different audiences. So they are attacking a foreign rival or target or whatever, but at the same time targeting domestic interests and domestic actors. So my answer to that question will be that very short one that I just gave. It's a synthesis, by the way.
Well, we ran out of time. Thank you so much. But we have some wine on the back, so we can keep on talking.
Sure.
And so, well, thank you, Seda, thank you, Ernesto, thank you all.
It's a real pleasure.